Hi all, Eric Girard here, founder and CEO of Brunt Workwear, and this is my startup story.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story, and every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning, and every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is the startup story. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Startup Story. How has 2021 started for you? Would you like a little boost in visibility for your business and brand? Then make sure to leave a review within Apple Podcasts and plug your brand in that review. In fact, here's an actual review from Ashley Borden, who gave the show a 5-star rating and wrote, "I continue to listen to The Startup Story and love how I am constantly learning with every single episode. You provide such valuable content to help me scale my business, ashleyborden.com. See how easy that was? And because Ashley included her URL in that review, 85,000 people just became aware of ashleyborden.com and will probably hit it up or Google it. Well, if that is a type of free advertising you would like, then make sure to leave a written review in Apple Podcasts today. And if you think your startup story is deserving of a full episode, then please visit thestartupstory.co/yourstory and submit your story for consideration for a featured episode. Everything I do is to provide you with the fuel you need to keep going. Now let's jump into this week's episode. My guest this week is Eric Girard, the founder of Brunt Workwear. Brunt Workwear is slowly becoming the workwear brand for those who are building everything that you and I rely on every day. Brunt Workwear is a D2C brand that seeks to serve one of the most underserved demographics out there, the tradesmen. Think about it. How many startups have you come across where their target persona is a welder, a crane operator, a construction worker, or a pipeline contractor? Yet it is that consumer persona that is far more loyal than any other persona out there. In fact, it is that persona that will tattoo your brand on their forearm, literally. Think about that. How many Google tattoos do you see? Zero. But how many Chevy, Ford, or Yeti tattoos do you see? Exactly. How is it that this massive, better than average income demographic has been overlooked for so long? Well, Eric actually shares his thoughts on this question because it was a demographic he grew up in, but paid zero attention to it with various other startups he helped to build. Startups like MJemmy, a luxury footwear brand, and Trade Coffee, a bougie coffee marketplace. If you still question whether or not this demographic is truly underserved when it comes to innovation and startups, then maybe, just for the second here, for a moment, let my guest roster be a reasonable sample size for you. See, after 110 episodes, do you know how many founders I had that started a business serving this demographic? None, until this very episode. So let's hear directly from Eric Girard exactly how his very eclectic entrepreneurial journey led him to start a company that serves one of the most loyal segments of consumers imaginable.
I grew up in a very small town, Bristol, Connecticut. So blue collar town. Parents were not entrepreneurs at all. Wasn't really surrounded by many entrepreneurs and didn't even really know what that actually meant until much later in life, really till high school. But I did get the bug early. Growing up in a small town, dad worked for Pratt & Whitney building airplane engines. Crazy hours, was working all the time just to support me and my two sisters. Also had a second job through a lot of my life, roofing for his friend's company. And eventually in my teenage years, I ended up going over there and working with them very young. So there was hustle and hard work, but it wasn't entrepreneur. It was blue collar, putting in as many hours as you can, earning the hourly wage. And because of that, you know, my dad wasn't around a lot because he was working to provide for the family. And my mom was really taking care of us and she was also working, but that was kind of divide and conquer. So I guess that was the only part that's carried through my life is just, you know, just the hard work, hard hours. And then seeing, you know, my parents always wanted the best for us, but couldn't always afford everything. And seeing them struggle and dad having to work even more to try to send me away to like soccer camp in the summer, things of that nature, was really what started to make me realize that being able to build a career and a life that hopefully doesn't have the stresses that my parents had was kind of an early motivation. And so
I'm laughing because the idea that entrepreneurship might not have those stresses is pretty comical, right?
Exactly. Quite the opposite. So that was kind of very early on. And then it was in elementary school. So probably third or fourth grade when I first started doing some entrepreneurial stuff. And there was a game that came out when I was in elementary school called Pogs, which you know, circular things that you threw a slammer on top of. And anyways, hopefully some people remember that.
Absolutely, they do.
So I was a big collector of those things. And I started trading with kids on the school bus, slammers and things of that nature, and started wheeling and dealing basically Pogs, not for money, but just getting things. And so that was like the earliest days where I had cut a deal with a young kid, and his dad ended up coming to my house and talking to my mom and saying, you know, where's this? And realizing that we actually did a trade, they actually thought I stole something from him. And he's like, oh, we just cut a bad deal. and so it was kind of funny. My mom was a little confused. But so it started there. And then really in middle school and in high school, you know, I had a lot of time on my hands. So I started making, this is embarrassing to say, but I started making hemp necklaces where I could do them at night and put beads and customize them for people and sell them to my friends, because that was kind of a trend back in middle school and early high school. So that was like really like, you know, small time childish stuff. But then at 14, I got my first job, started working for my dad's friend's roofing company, technically illegal, I guess, at age 14. But that was really where I got the bug. And then, you know, I remember my first paycheck, I think I was getting like $8 an hour, but and it worked a 40-hour week. And, you know, at the end of the week, he handed me, you know, a stack of money. And I was like, wow, that was like, you know, I got to be outside in the sun using my muscles to lift up shingles, and I got paid for it. And it was just like, that's incredible.
That's awesome.
And that kind of started everything. And then it continued on from there. But that's kind of like the early stage, was really small time trading, then making small time products, and then really getting my first job. And that's kind of the early journey.
It's funny you mentioned Pogs, because our very first episode featured Jason McCann from Veridesk, now Veri. And part of his story was, on the tail end of Pogs, he created a game similar to it, and he tries to sell it to a toy company, or tries to sell distribution through a toy company. And the toy VP said, you know, that ship has sailed. Like, no one's interested in that anymore. And he has a truck for about $50,000 in Pog game equipment, Pog-esque game equipment. And he's like, what am I going to do with this now? And so it's funny you bring up Pogs. But when we think to your journey and those micro hustles, if you will, but yet now you're working with a roofing company, you've seen a job, how it, you know, your work equals X amount of dollars. Your parents have surrounded you with the idea of stability when it comes to employment. What did you think you wanted to do coming the end of your high school years?
So after that roofing job, I actually started my own landscaping business.
Okay.
Started it when I was 15 for neighbors. So I was literally going across the street, mowing their lawns, doing their work. I was, you know, I was in shape and I was whatever. I was affordable. And so people like that. And so when I was 15, I actually started doing it for people in other neighborhoods and friends of my family, or my sister actually got me a few jobs. And I couldn't drive yet. I didn't have my license. So my mom would actually, I would take my dad's lawnmower, put it in the back of her SUV. She would drive me, drop me off, and then come pick me up after the job was done. And then when I was doing like mulch and things of that nature, I'd have to call the mulching company, have them deliver it to the person's house. And then my mom would drop me off, and then I would do the work, and she'd come back at the end of the day. So I had done that, not massively large, because I was a pretty avid athlete, a three-season athlete between soccer and running. So I was doing it after practices in the evening and then over the weekends. And so, but it was pretty good. It was stable. And then I eventually had some of my buddies come work with me. And so there was a point where I thought that was what I was going to do after high school, was going to turn that into a full-time business and expand and all that. But then my mom, which I give her credit for, because neither my parents had gone off to college, said, listen, you've got a knack at a young age for business. You should start looking at some of these, you know, going into business in a business school. And so I wasn't sure if I wanted to go to college and all that stuff. And so we ended up going and touring some of these schools. And I ended up, she brought me to one called Babson, which is up in Massachusetts, in Wellesley, Massachusetts, and was just blown away with everything about it, from the campus to the people. It was a totally different world. Probably my last 2 years in high school. And I had really good grades. So that was unusual. I wouldn't say I'm a very smart, high IQ person, but I was able to get good grades because I worked really hard and like would study really hard and use flashcards, but I wasn't like off the charts SATs smart. It ended up working that I ended up getting into Babson. And that was a big, you know, one was I was going to go start my own, you know, landscaping business. And then I got into Babson, and luckily she put me on that path and changed my life. It was probably the best thing that could ever happen.
That's awesome. I'm not going to lie. When you were talking about your intelligence and IQ and you're raised in the New England area of Massachusetts, Connecticut, I was really hoping you're going to say, I wasn't wicked smart. But
Exactly.
I was really hoping that was smart. The phrase you're going to use. I was like, oh, yeah, yeah.
I get that all the time.
I love it. So college is a very formative time for us. We're processing the things that we think we want to do. A lot of times our eyes are open more to what the opportunities are. Again, back to influences, right? We are who we surround ourselves with. And so based on how you were navigating the college years, coming the end of college, what did you think you wanted to do? Because your eyes are a bit open, your perspective's a bit broader. What did that next step look like for you?
College was unbelievable. So it was complete shock for me, because coming from the small town of Bristol, Connecticut, going to a school like Babson, there were freshmen there that had businesses doing tens of millions of dollars. And I didn't even understand what that even meant, right? And there were a lot of international students. So it was really diverse, people from all over the world, different nationalities, different religions. And I didn't even see any of that from my hometown. So I was thrown into something that was very uncomfortable and unusual, but was very social and got along with a lot of people. So that kind of helped grease my jumping into a whole new world.
Yeah.
It opened up my eyes and was like, wow, there's like a big world out there. There's like so much opportunity. You can kind of do whatever you want if you really want to. But I was still pretty conservative in college just because of my upbringing. And my parents were very conservative. Mm. And so my mom was, you should get a very stable job. You know, your uncle was a CPA back in the day and did very well for himself. You should go into something that's very stable, like accounting or finance. And that was the path actually I started on, which was going down an accounting kind of finance route, mostly because of the stability of it.
Yeah.
Not that it's ever really stable, but it was more stable than trying to start my own company at the time. And that was a terrible decision. I was a terrible accountant. I have ADD, I can't sit in front of a monitor for 10 hours a day in Excel spreadsheets, which is required to do that. And so, but ended up going down that path and knew one day that I actually wanted to start a company, but thought it was going to be very much later in life after I was stable and all that stuff. So coming out of college was very conservative, coming out of a school that mostly breeds, entrepreneurs. And I was going into a somewhat of a conservative career path at that point.
That's incredible. Now, there's a lot of steps that take place between college and where we are today with Brent Workwear.
Yes, yes.
And in fact, I don't know if I've seen a more diverse journey in entrepreneurship across my 110 episodes. There are times where I can see these breadcrumbs, and I refer to the breadcrumbs a ton throughout the startup story because there is a path and a thread that gets us there. So I'm interested to find out what is the common thread across all your different experiences, because you had mentioned you have ADD, and whether that was in jest or in seriousness.
Diagnosed but untreated.
So legit then. So I'm not going to lie. When I saw your entrepreneurial pathway, I thought, this is entrepreneur ADD. Like, I mean, he's all over the map with industries and sector. And so I'm just like, so walk us through how we get from Babson to Brent Workwear and all the different steps you took, because I know my listeners are going to be fascinated, especially that I teed it up that it's so disparate across what they are, but maybe it's your role that's the common thread in shaping you to where you are today. But help walk us through Babson to Brent Workwear.
Yep. So coming out of Babson, so I went into the accounting world. Safe bet, was actually very bad at the job, was not qualified for it, was incapable of it, only kept the job because I was very, like I said, I was very social and very outgoing. And I was actually able to bring business in, which is really in accounting world, that's what partners do. Partners go out and bring in the business and the staff, which is what I was, do all the work. But I was actually bringing in clients, which are all my Babson connections who ran these companies. And so the firm kept me around because they were like, he's pretty valuable, even though he's incapable of actually doing the accounting. But one of the partners actually there took me under his wing and said, listen, you're going to grind this out. Maybe we'll create a sales type role for you. But it's like, we're fitting a square peg in a round hole. He's like, my brother is a top sales executive at a big company called EMC, which is now owned by Dell. Mm-hmm. He's like, with some proper sales training, military style sales training, he's like, you could be exceptional. And that was a big step in my life, because I was in the conservative path, and I don't know if I would have gotten off that path. And so he ended up introducing me, ended up moving over to that company, rounds of interviews, and got in. And that was really like my college education in sales.
Yeah.
You go in for 6 weeks, you don't do any work. They just train you to be like a sales assassin. They invest heavy up front. And it was perfect because I was naturally good at relationships and communicating, but, and they taught me the process of discipline and follow through and the seven step, all these things. Thought I was going to do that forever and loved it. And it was top of my class. All that stuff was on a path to, you know, there was a lot of money in front of me and offers, but it was at right at 1 year. So I was there for only 1 year and when things were going great. And I'm like, you know, I'm going to be here for 50 years, retire here. And then I got introduced to a serial entrepreneur named Ben Fishman, who had started when he was in high school, Lids, the baseball cap company store. So they're all over, you know, 600 stores around the country now. He was in his early 40s and he was running. He had started and was the CEO of a company called Ruelala, R-U-E-L-A-L-A, a big online fashion flash sale business. Think higher end TJ Maxx, but online.
Okay. What year was that real quick? Let's put a timestamp on that.
That was 2012.
2012. Okay. So well into the internet era, well into e-commerce. Like we're rich in that period. So
exactly. Yeah. 2.0 of e-commerce. So I got introduced to him and was like, you know, I took the meeting and took the interview just because his resume was so incredible. And Ruelala had already blown up. It had sold for $350 million. So, and it was just astronomical not to take the meeting. He and I ended up connecting incredibly well, just personally, the way he works and what he needed and all that. And so I ended up quitting that sales job, which I thought I was going to literally retire at that company, because my thesis was I had the entrepreneurial bug. I knew I wanted to do that later on in life, but this is the chance of a lifetime. And if I can't survive, it doesn't work, I can go back into sales, you know, 10 years from now. So I left. And, you know, my parents were super nervous. You have this really good job. You finally have a clear path to pay off your student loans and all this stuff. And now you quit. So that was a big transition. That was accounting to sales. And then now I'm going into the startup world. And even though the business was quite big and successful already, it was 2 years in, 200 employees, growing incredibly rapid. And it was a mess in terms of every day was things were breaking.
What were you coming on board for?
So I joined him in this new role that he created called the chief of staff role, which was new at the time, but is a little bit more common now. And I was his right-hand man to manage all external relationships. So my sales background lended well to that. So Ruelala, we were in the market a lot, meeting with all the executives and CEOs of all the big fashion brands from Coach and Tory Burch and all that. And I was his proxy. I'd go to every meeting with him. I was basically attached to the hip with him. He would cut a deal or make an arrangement, and it was my job to then see that through, bring that back with the leadership team and the merch, you know, and the team, and execute that so he could pull off.
All right, before we continue on, I just want to ask you, the Startup Story listener, a question. How amazing would it be to learn directly from a founder of a $300+ million brand, much like Eric did with the founder of Lids? It would be remarkable, right? Well, that is the experience and the knowledge sharing that is delivered to you each quarter when you become a Grindology member. Grindology is an entrepreneurial subscription box that ships every quarter full of resources to help fuel your grind and your hustle. So what is included in your Grindology shipment? Well, each quarter you receive a box, the Grindology box. And inside that box are two bags of uniquely crafted coffee specifically roasted for you, the founder, hustler, entrepreneur, maker, and creator. And each shipment also includes an exclusive mug that speaks to the unique nature that is you, the entrepreneur. And those things are remarkable and they are incredible. And man, the coffee is so good. But the best thing, arguably the most important thing, is that every single Grindology shipment will include a copy of the Grindology Tactical Manual. And every single issue of that manual will be chock full of real tactics from real business builders, not journalists. Founder direct. Much like when Eric sat with the founder of Lids for all those years, he learned so much. That's what's inside this Grindology Tactical Manual. Within the pages of this, we will be delivering you tactics and strategies that you can integrate into your business immediately. How great would it be to receive real marketing funnel strategies from those who are doing it? Wouldn't it be helpful if a successful founder laid out specific user acquisition strategies they use to grow their business? Well, those are the types of tactics that will be found in each issue of Grindology. Like I said, real tactics from real business builders. Everything about Grindology is about helping to fuel your grind. That is why our friends at Design Pickle have partnered with our very first shipment by hooking up one lucky member with a full year of unlimited graphic design services. That's a prize valued at close to $12,000. You can visit Grindology.com to learn more. And of course, we're going to include a link in the show notes for easy access. But like I said earlier, we ship our first box this month and it's an exclusive shipment. So make sure to secure your box today at Grindology.com. Now let's get back to our episode. What makes the startup story unique is access to certain people, right? It's correct. Hearing the story, hearing the tactics. And here you are attached to a serial entrepreneur that has done multiple huge businesses and brands.
Right.
When you look back on that, and now we can start seeing, okay, I can see how we start laying down some breadcrumbs to get to where we are at Brunt Workwear. Yep. But when you look back to that season working with Ben, like, what are some key learnings that will just never leave you?
The key learning was I took a huge pay cut, right? When I left EMC, they countered and gave me a huge package to stay.
Yeah.
And I left like lots of money on the table. And that made all the difference. If I let the money make that decision, I wouldn't be where I am today. And I'd still be selling software, basically, which, by the way, is a great career. But the lesson I learned is I was 23 at the time when I joined him. So if you're young enough and you don't have a family, don't have a house and you can afford to, take either a massive pay cut, work for free, find the right person that you want to learn from, and whatever it takes, free, discount. The experience that I got, a front row seat sitting alongside a serial entrepreneur who's built massive companies in every single meeting he was a part of, investor meetings, acquisition conversations, everything was like—
That's incredible.
It was a intense MBA in e-commerce. And I knew nothing about that going in, right? I knew nothing about e-commerce. I knew nothing about building a brand. I knew nothing about building a company. And over those 3 years, I wasn't his executive assistant. He had an executive assistant, but my mentality was, one, I need to learn as much from this person as possible. And if I do a good job, there's big opportunities ahead of me. And two, I need to make his life as easy as possible because that shows my value. So I would do whatever it was to help him stay focused on the core business. And I would try to take as much off of his plate and do as much of the work as possible, crafting, building decks and things of that nature, and then having him bless them. So that was really it. The big lesson is if you find someone that is in the space, you want to, figure out whatever it takes to be able to work for them, and then make sure you're providing enough value for them to keep you around.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just think to the idea of sitting with him and, I mean, man, you were a part of capital discussions, right? You would have had learnings from that. Logistics and operations.
Yep.
The sourcing side of conversations. You mentioned, acquisitions. My goodness, the value in sitting in those discussions and learning how the negotiation process works and how to just work the nuance of seeking an acquisition. I mean, just there's so much that you probably learned in that period that I think would probably take up an entirely other episode. Exactly. And maybe we will have to have you back for a 2.0 to just unpack the learnings of sitting with him. But you're not there now. So as rich as that opportunity was, what drew you away from that opportunity?
Well, so we went through another transaction. So the business was simultaneous transaction. Rue La La was then bought by eBay for 24 hours. And then it was simultaneously bought back by our chairman at the time. So after that transaction happened, the business was built, the new owner, no major opportunity or outcome left, basically. So the leadership, a lot of leadership team all parted ways, was moving on. Ben's a serial entrepreneur. He wanted to start a new company. I couldn't work with him for a period of time. So we all parted ways for about a year. And I just basically stayed afloat during that year knowing, I eventually wanted to work with him. And ended up coming back and joining him under this umbrella called Launch, which is a venture builder. It was his thesis. He didn't want to be just an investor after selling Rue La La. He wanted to actually continue to build businesses. And it was kind of this model. So I knew I didn't have enough experience at that point yet to start I probably could have, but I wasn't confident enough and I didn't have enough skill sets. And I didn't have leadership skills and managing skills yet. And that was important for me. People are like, why didn't you do it earlier? And it's like, I wasn't ready yet to do it. And maybe I could have, but I wasn't.
Let me pause on that real quick. That readiness, right? I think a lot of times in the entrepreneurial journey, we're waiting for a perfect season or there's some metric we're looking for to say, this is the time in which I am ready. Was it only just the leadership side of readiness that you were looking for? Or was there really some idea? Because again, I don't know if there was any financial benefit for the sale of Rue La La for you, but maybe was there a financial security you were looking for? Like, what was the pause in moving forward on something?
So when I joined Rue La La, right, it was, around $200 million. And when we left, it was about $550 million. So I saw a mid-stage growth company for that size business. I had never seen starting something from scratch. I missed that.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's a different game.
Yes.
And so it was one, I wanted to see that. And the good news is sitting there firsthand, seeing it, I can replicate those things. But if I don't see it, it's really hard. You know, I can't read a book and then go do it. I need to see it. And so I knew I wanted to see that early stage. And so that's where when I went to launch, I knew I was going to see that. And then I had never managed people directly reporting to me. I was high up in a big organization, but I was a proxy. I wasn't I didn't have direct staff. So those were the two things that I knew I needed to learn. Wasn't sure if I could do them, wasn't sure if I couldn't do them, but needed to learn. And so that's why I ended up going over to launch and had a front row seat at a couple businesses.
That's incredible. So at one, I applaud you for your patience. Because I think a lot of times in the entrepreneur, I've heard stories of, you know, people leaving financially lucrative careers because they have a great idea on a napkin and they're like, I'm out, I'm all in. It's like, oh, there are so many steps before you needed to do that, you know?
Yep.
And here you are young, and I assume the financial burden of life hasn't quite laid on top of your shoulders yet with the mortgage and the spouse and all that. And so I applaud you for your patience, especially given the, you talked about before, the diagnosed and untreated ADD. Like, you know, I assume the idea of just constantly jumping and looking for the next new thing, and yet you stayed the course and saw the opportunity and learning opportunities. And I love every bit about that. So what at launch, and this, and all of this is starting to come together now as to why I can see such a varied batch of experience in startups. Mm-hmm. And it's really probably because of your time with launch. First off, what was the business model of launch? Because you said venture builder, but in my mind, I looked at it and thought, okay, launch is probably an incubator, right? But you know, and it sounds like it, but the term venture builder was a very intentional term used. So what was the model behind launch?
It's very intentional. So incubators, you know, the typical incubator model is give 100 companies, $50,000, $100,000, hopefully one of them or two of them end up becoming the next WeWork or the Airbnb. The other 98 don't work out, but that's fine. You only need one or two winners. You let those people, those entrepreneurs, build those companies on their own. Launch was very, we only had, well, the first year we only had one business.
Okay.
And the leadership team, that a lot of the folks that had been at Real Law before, were all working on the business. So it was putting very experienced folks who have done this before intentionally behind a business versus just deploying capital and letting someone else run it.
Okay.
So truly building them from scratch and operating them very intensely, not checking in everyone, you know, every couple of weeks on, hey, how you doing over there? You know, so that was launch's model early on and has been.
So what brands did you get to be a part of at launch?
The first business that launch had started was MGemmy. And I had no interest in getting into the luxury, you know, direct to consumer Italian luxury shoe business.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was about a week before it was about to launch, and the marketing was not completely set up by any means. And so I kind of got asked, hey, can you step in and help fix and build some of this marketing stuff? And I was kind of hemming and hawing, you know, I don't want to get stuck in this. I want to work on a new company that I'm interested in, and ended up going in, getting some of the piping and the plumbing installed in the marketing world, so to speak. Was a good soldier, you know, helping keep this thing going. And then I was done. I did my duties. They built out, there was a CMO there. They started to hire the people. I was going to go back to launch and start to work on a business. And Ben approached me and said, hey, listen, this is a women's only business. I know you have no interest in it. Would you be interested in launching the men's version of MGemmy? So I said, that's an interesting opportunity. You know, I'll get to run my own P&L with inside a bigger company, hire my own folks. You know, that'll be a good step and fill some of those voids. And so I took that and did that for about 2 years. So I jumped in to MGemmy full time to run the men's division, spent about a year traveling over in Italy and all the factories, the men's shoes, building the brand. We were going to name it a new brand. So we were really building a whole new company. And then at the last minute, we decided to actually put it together, which was the right decision. And then spent about a year running that business and got it up and running, got it to a few million bucks, and was great. But I knew I didn't want to be in a merchant essentially for the rest of my career, which the purse to run that division and business, he really needed to be like a shoe merchant. And,
I
could have continued on. It was going to set me down a different path.
Got it. So what was your next step after that? And this is all within launch, mind you. I mean, these steps are all within launch.
Yeah, that was 2 years. And so then I went back to launch, and the goal was to look at what's the next, you know, what's a new business opportunity. So I was literally just diligencing inbound stuff and outbound stuff.
I just picture this whiteboard of just business ideas that Ben and the team are kind of percolating. And so you come in, you check in, you're like, okay, I've done with that. What's next on this whiteboard that we can build out? Is that really, I mean, that's what it feels like.
we were going through in the first 2 years, we were looking at about 120 different business business plans a year. You know, we had a lot of inbound too. People would come to us, hey, I don't have the ability to start them, but we know you do. We would look at inbound, but then also create our own where we thought the opportunity was. So it was high volume, high intensity. And the goal was prove why they won't work. And the ones that end up making it through all the hole poking probably have a pretty good chance, right? And bringing in big time investors and having them poke holes in them and why that won't work and all that stuff. So yeah, so I went back to launch, was like, okay, what's, you know, I want to be, you know, what's the next business? And that's where the opportunity for Trade Coffee had come up. I had picked up an inbound string from a large investment firm known as JB Holdings. We never heard of them, kind of a big private company. And, you know, they own everything in the coffee world, basically, from Peet's and Caribou, Einstein Bagels, and a lot more. They're just insanely large. And I knew nothing about coffee. Literally, I drank Dunkin' Donuts every single day. And that was about as much as I knew. And they happen to own Keurig, and I drank Keurig, so that was kind of funny. So yeah, so that was a completely different one. You know, they had an idea that, hey, the future of coffee is online, and we have no idea what that means. We owned a lot of the market, literally market share, like large percentage of the entire coffee market. We know you guys know how to build businesses. Let's talk. And so, and that started the relationship. And so for almost a year, I sat in the corner of an office in Boston. We had this cool open space and was twisting and turning, like, what's the opportunity for this coffee market? And we had two strategies. One was, do we be the everything for coffee, like the Amazon of coffee, but, you know, from low end Dunkin' Donuts to super high end and everything in between. And we're top to bottom. And then the other strategy was going after the craft space, which, you know, well, you know, all these roasters were popping up and we were seeing them, and it was following a little bit of the trend, like microbrews had happened over the prior 10 years. Yep. You know, brands were really strong, brands were really important. And there was a lot, you know, we knew nothing. So we had immersion into coffee. You know, we flew out to Peet's headquarters, met the original founder of Starbucks, Jerry Baldwin. A lot of people don't realize there was three founders originally, and he was on the board of Peet's. And so we did cuppings and all this crazy coffee stuff, which is really coffee nerd speak, soda. And we got pretty deep into coffee. And even though, even today, I'm still not a coffee aficionado by any means, it helped us understand the market.
Yeah.
And then that was that business plan turned into, we started to build out the team and then started to hire some executives. We actually found them in New York City. And so then the company ended up being based in New York City. We all lived in Boston, but essentially that was going to be home base for it. And that was my path in launch.
So interesting, for those that don't know what Trade Coffee is. Trade Coffee is not a coffee brand. They are a brand that delivers unique coffees that you probably wouldn't discover on your own, is really what it is. And so it's really a platform for coffee, unique coffee roasters, craft roasters to reach their consumers. And when you look at your personal journey across the many different ventures from Rue La La to MGemmy, well, within MGemmy, the men's line, and now Trade, like, up to that point, you were brand building a specific brand of the product. I mean, maybe not Rue La La, because that's really a liquidation retail, right?
Yeah.
You know, but MGemmy for sure, single brand building. Now you're looking at a business model where you're not building a single brand.
Correct.
Based on your experience, based on the conversations taking place, why did that make sense? Because what you hear so often is the brand is the equity and the IP and the opportunity, the brand. But really, it's a platform of discovery is what it is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it is a brand to some degree, but it is a marketplace business, right? And it was the first time I've ever been a very different model, right? Marketplace business. Yep. And it evolved that way kind of naturally as we were doing what's the best model to go into the market. I would have loved to create our own brand, you know, as the Blue Bottles, Intelligentsia of the world. But it was, the opportunity there was already, you know, those businesses were already getting bought and sold for hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah. It was the business opportunity that drove us to the model. So that's why we ended up going into that. And fast forward, you know, the reason I decided to leave that business to now start Brunt is I wasn't suited for a marketplace business. Mm. You know, I built a supply chain. I was there for 2 years. I flew around, you know, the country, signed all the roasters up, came back, did marketing. But it is, a marketplace business is such a different animal and such, it requires such a different skill set. And I quite frankly, wasn't excited about it or interested in it. I was excited about building it. Like, I loved building it and flying around and building the supply chain, and then early on testing some of the marketing. But it is a very operationally intensive business, and it took us a while to find the right CEO to put into that business. And we found the exact right one. Incredibly operationally tight. The reason that business works is how tight it is run and operated in a marketplace model. There is a brand there, but that's not what drives the business. Yeah. It is a performance operational engine. And that's not how I'm built. That's not how I'm designed. That's not how I think. And I would be the worst person to ever run that type of company.
For those listening, though, you know, they're hearing this and they're probably thinking, okay, if they're aware of trade and they understand the model, they understand why we're calling it a marketplace. If they're not aware, they at least understand the idea of a marketplace. For those who aren't familiar with it, think of an Etsy, right? You're thinking of a place where people are able to find, you know, or I think of Uncommon Goods as well. There's another brand that's a marketplace, if you will.
Yeah.
Can you help unpack what is it about a marketplace business that takes a unique skill set? Because from outside perspective, you think, okay, wow, it's almost like the field of dreams. I build the platform, vendors and people come to it, and I'm just getting a piece of the transaction, if you will. What is it about a marketplace that is challenging and most people aren't aware of?
Well, especially a marketplace where the retail price points are anywhere from, like, you know, 15 to 25 or 30 bucks. It'd be, you know, eBay and things of that nature are different. You can sell high dollar items. But if you have a good margin business, low margin dollars, right? So every transaction, you're only making so much money. So in a marketplace business, you're not the brand. So you're having to get your product from someone. Then you're then having to resell it, right? So there's a bunch of mouths to feed there. And the only way, you know, marketplaces generally work when they get huge. So they have to be very big businesses, right? So running a $5 or $10 million marketplace is very hard to do and run it profitably, because you have to get them big. So like eBay's, or even Amazon's market, you know, all these things, when they get big, they work, scale. And to get to that big point, the big stage, which trades on its way, is you have to be incredibly operationally efficient at building a business, like maniacal, you know, real good operator, real good financial controls, all that stuff. And even then it might not work. And so it's just a different skill set that I am not built for. And never will be, right? Like, that's not my DNA. Like, I can go do brand marketing, and I can go create buzz and excitement, but in a marketplace, that doesn't always translate to customers and retention and churn and all that stuff.
Yeah, I love that. And right now, you know, I want to make sure that we spend a significant amount of time talking about Brunt Workwear, because of we can now see how Brunt Workwear is kind of the amalgamation of your entire journey. And you've seen both sides, and you've assessed your skill set, you've learned a ton in all those different brands. And is it safe to say that your departure from trade was because of a vision you had for Brunt Workwear?
Yep, exactly. So I knew I wanted, after trade, I was ready to start my own company. Hands down, I had the experience. You know, trade was, you know, I helped build a company that I didn't even, you know, wasn't even in the space. So I was like, okay, if I can do that, then I can do it in something I actually care about and are passionate about. And so that was the plan, was, you know, and it was great, because the CEO had come on board, the team was building out. So I didn't, you know, and I stayed on to make sure everything, you know, transitioned over very smoothly. I knew I wanted to build a business that I was incredibly passionate about, because I had been building businesses the prior years that I didn't, you know, they were good business opportunities, but I didn't love the category, so to speak. I didn't even, you know, love coffee or Italian luxury shoes. I got into them because I was excited, but it wasn't like my passion.
I want to tee up for my listeners real quick how funny that sentence was, because when you find out what Brunt Workwear is, to come off that I wasn't passionate about coffee and Italian luxury shoes. So when you find out how polar opposite Brunt Workwear is, it is so fascinating to know now exactly what you're wired for. And but coming off of really the polar opposite, really, I mean, couldn't be any farther from what Brunt Workwear is.
Exactly. So it took some time to figure out exactly what I was going to do. I had the idea for Brunt Workwear 5 years prior, but I put it on the shelf because I knew I wasn't ready. And I also didn't think I could reach the customer base, and I didn't know enough about the market. And it was when I was running MGME Men's, but I kind of packed it in the back of my mind. So I ended up leaving trade and started working on a business plan for Brunt Workwear. And the thesis was, So my best friends to this day are still my buddies from high school that I did landscaping with and roofing with. And I still go home and see them, or they come up and see me. We go ATVing and all this stuff. They always said, you know, why aren't you going to, you're building all these like fancy businesses, coffee, and why don't you build a business for us? And so two things struck a chord when they said that. And it was, one, that's what I'm passionate about. You know, these guys, yeah. These are my buddies. I care about that. That's how I grew up. And then two was the market for guys like them is so massive. We're building these luxury businesses in Italian fashion and for the 1% of the 1% of the 1%. And the coffee we're selling is by no means, you know, on the supermarket aisle. And I just knew like the majority of the country are like how me and my buddies grew up, not buying, you know, $250 luxury shoes and $25 bags of coffee. So that was it. No research, no nothing. But that was the idea to get the idea started. And I started talking to launch and pitching, just talking to some investors. And the investment world is they are the 1% of the 1% of the 1%. And so to grasp this customer base and the concept that I was developing was very hard. People didn't think it was possible, didn't think the market was there. You know, there was a lot of unknowns because my buddies weren't their buddies and vice versa. They didn't grow up like I grew up. And so it was hard at first.
I want to pause you real quick there. One of the things that you had mentioned, like when you had talked about your buddies, you know, when are you going to build a brand for us? I'm so big on words. Like I'm so big on the how the brain and the heart connect for what comes out of our mouth. And they use the phrase us. That tells me that they see a distinction between their consumer patterns and what you were, the consumer patterns of those you were building. Can you help unpack the persona of the us and what really what drove you to starting Brunt? Like, what is this persona of us that doesn't connect with the others?
That was like the biggest unlock, right? And so these guys, from an entrepreneur perspective and from a venture capital perspective, often overlooked and underserved because the category isn't quote unquote as sexy as fashion or whatever it may be. For them, for us, and it's funny because it's a lifestyle, right? So it's waking up 5-6 days a week, very early in the morning, lacing up your work boots, putting on your work gear, getting in the truck, going to work, working 10-12 hours a day, mostly standing on your feet, making a very good living, especially at a young age, right? Not going to college, going right into the trades. So no debt. Buying a house relatively early, right? Where I couldn't, I had college debt, all these things. Being able to support a family, work hard, but support a family, living like a really solid, hard-earned, proud lifestyle. And then that lifestyle bleeds into the weekend and you know, and that doesn't change. You know, it's not just a 9-to-5 Monday through Friday. And then all of a sudden you go out on the weekend and you're changing. You're working on your house. You're working on your truck. You're taking care of your family. You're taking care. I call it the backbone of the country. It's the people that are doing the work that are keeping the infrastructure going, keeping the buildings going, keeping everything around us that sometimes is easy to take for granted.
Yeah.
It's keeping everything moving in good times and bad times. And so when they say that, that's who they identify as, right? And they think of themselves that way. And they know, and there's a little bit of like, who's looking out for us? Who's watching out for us, right? All, you know, it's, especially when they saw what I was doing. You're spending all this energy building like these luxury businesses.
Yeah.
Imagine you put that energy into building a business for us.
You know, you had to pitch this idea. And again, real quick, before we continue on, tell my listeners what Brunt Workwear is as we continue this conversation.
Yep. So Brunt Workwear. So the thesis for the business is there hasn't been a modern workwear brand in the category in decades, if not more. All the workwear brands, so you think of workwear brands like the Carhartts and the Timberlands and the Red Wings of the world, they're all 100-year-old brands. They trade on heritage and they've been around forever. The high-level thesis is I wanted to build a modern brand that resonated with the modern construction customer and trades worker, who are all my buddies and my dad and all these folks. And the customer base, there's two groups. There's the group that's aging out of that career, but there's the up and coming crew, which are my buddies and younger. I wanted to create a brand that resonated with them, that was incredibly authentic, spoke to them, understood them, took care of them, delivered not only the products, but the services and the solutions in a modern way that those other companies will never be able to do because they're so big and old.
You had to pitch this to numerous investors for seed capital. So you know some data points around these people. And again, having had, over 100 founders on the show, I don't have a founder who is serving I'm gonna say blue collar America. Like that's not the segment that most of them are serving.
Correct.
So what is it about? Give us some stats on this demographic. All right. I mean, because again, venture capital, it's a great story. It's a great population that needs to be served, but they care a lot about numbers and metrics. Like, how big is this marketplace? What are their buying patterns? Are they the ones buying the $90,000 boats on the weekends? Like, you know, like tell what is it about this persona? What are some data points you can share with us?
So globally, 22 million folks. So it's a massive market, right? Yeah. US alone is about 13 million folks that fit into the category. And that's if you're looking at like Bureau of Labor Statistics data, which classifies jobs and blue collar and white collar, all that stuff. So huge market. And the blue collar job essentially makes up 13.9% of all the jobs in the country. Wow. So it's depending on, you know, some people say that's a small market, some people, but if the number's massive, right? It's a really large market. So investors like big markets. The problem with big markets are, you know, the biggest thing with them is there's incumbents and there's, you know, how are you going to disrupt, you know, where I see them, like it's easy, you know, you can build a brand. It's really easy to disrupt. They see the opposite, which is how are you going to disrupt these companies that have heritage, hundreds of years, much more capital, much more learnings, much more expertise. Yeah. And so very big market, which is can help, but also raises a lot of questions.
Are their buying patterns different from how they acquire, again, not knowing the work boot space, the work wear space, if you will? Are their buying patterns different? Is it something that they have to go into a store in order to try on, or is it something that they trust online with?
Yeah, so that was a big question. So buying patterns are definitely different. Unlike the fashion business, someone buys a pair of shoes, they'll have it for 5-10 years. Hmm. This product is literally, it's the tools they wear, right? Yeah. So it is a disposable product that is not a discretionary purchase. So they have to buy these products to do their job. They go through them at a relatively rapid pace. Typically 2 pairs of work boots a year, a couple of pairs of pants. These are products that they're tools. They're not fashion items. Yeah. They're not discretionary, you know, so there is a very unique purchasing pattern for these items, you know, and then the big question is online versus in store, right? And that was the big uncovering was the heritage brands that are traditionally retail store and typically going after the businesses were built on the older demographic, like my dad's demographic, like now in the 50s and 60s and 70s. But I believed I could get this younger customer who is more savvy online and an online shopper and trusting and all that stuff. And so that was a little bit of a big question that is proving itself out true.
Are you finding those who adopt the online buying of workwear to be of a certain age demographic? I mean, on the younger side versus those that are aging out into retirement?
It generally is. So the data proves that, though we have customers, you know, we have much older customers and much younger customers. You know, we have young teenagers who are like me, you know, starting out 14, 15 who are buying our product. And we have people in their 70s that have been buying our product. So it runs the gamut, but it is definitely that 25 to 35 year old is the sweet spot.
That's incredible. What has been the biggest surprise for you once you've gotten to launch? And we're going to unpack a little bit of your pre-launch story, but once you've launched, what was the biggest surprise in the first year for you, whether it be on the operations side, whether it be on the consumer purchasing side, the product itself? Like, what just really surprised you based on your going in thesis?
The biggest surprise was how well the brand was received so quickly. You know, I was expecting, you know, brands take a long time to develop in time and customers to get in the market. We had done so much work on building the brand and I knew the customer better than anyone in the market. I know it's, you know, literally my buddies were in the research sessions with this big firm, you know, that we could talk about. We had done so much work on the brand, brunt, the name, bearing the brunt of the workday for the, like all this stuff. And we had modeled the business pretty conservatively, but we expected it to be a slower growth and the brand would take a few years to build. And the brand was so strong. It's like, people want anything we put our name on, right? And it's dangerous because we can put it on anything and they'll buy it, but that we got to control what Brunt stands for and what Brunt means. You know, it's easy to slap a logo on a lot of things because people want it. And so I was incredibly surprised at how fast and how strong the brand was adopted by the exact target customer we were going after, because I just thought it was going to take longer to build.
That's incredible. You know, your slogan, the tools you wear, was that intentional? Do you only want to stay in apparel? Or now you've built the brand, you're thinking that might be somewhat limiting?
So the tools you wear is incredibly intentional. And the reason reason so is it had come up. So when we did customer research, we did qual and quantitative. So qualitative is talking literally phone calls with my buddies and my friends and people that we didn't know across the country in different pockets, talking to them and hearing threads. You do quantitative to, you know, high scale research surveys that validate the data. In the qualitative research, that line came up like multiple times. Do you care about how your boots look? No, you know, I don't. They do, but they say they don't. Yeah. No, the, you know, they're tools I wear. Like, I need them to do their job. I don't clean them. You know, I take them off at the end of the day. I'm going to replace them. They're tools I wear. They're not fashion items. It came up multiple times. It just was like such a dead smack. And the good news is the tools you wear is everything from head to toe. It's a lot of options, not too limiting. And the key there is, you know, we're not going to get into real tools. Like, I don't picture us making a hammer or things of that nature, because that's like that's a hardware business. That's a tool business. But things that make these workers' lives easier on a daily basis, that is something that they wear, is open field. So, you know, head to toe. And then there's, you know, you think of, and we're not going to go into all these categories, but you walk into any of these stores, it's everything from boots to the socks, to pants, to accessories, to hats, to hard hats, tool belts. I'm not sure if, you know, that one's on the fringe there, but the categories that we can go into under the tools you wear is, you know, there's probably of the whole market, $35 billion market, that's probably $10 to $15 billion market, right? Not that you get the whole market, but. Yeah.
Wow. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. So when you had this idea, now back to the beginning stages of Bryant Workwear. So when you had this idea and you're pitching it to the team at launch, what was some of the pushback that you received, if any? Because it's such a, again, the marketplace, the demographic is not one that people think of serving when it comes to the startup community.
First and foremost was brand loyalty to these 100-year-old incumbents. Mm-hmm. Why would anyone ever leave trusted, tried and true, father wore it, grandfather wore it, they're not leaving a heritage brand? That was a big, big question mark, which is a good question, right? How are you going to disrupt? And so that I had to work through, which was very critical, very important. And we still didn't know if that was possible until the day we launched the brand. So that was big pushback. Two, is the customer going to shop online? Which we already hit on, but that was very important. You know, do they need to try them on? How are they going to buy work boots online and all that stuff? And we built strategies and tools around that to solve that exact issue. And then three, a lot of these investors think of, you know, one-time customer transactions. And so thinking about LTV, lifetime value, the customer, if you build a brand, you know, all that stuff was, you know, they think you buy a pair of work boots in their worlds, that'll last them 5 or 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so having to explain how this customer actually uses the product is very different than when they buy a pair of Brunt work boots.
Yeah.
If they buy their Brunt work boots, they will have them 10 years from now. Our core customer that buys our work boots, they'll be getting another pair by the end of the year. And that's normal course for them.
That's incredible. Absolutely love it. Absolutely love it. What about inventory though? I mean, you know, when I think of what you're trying to do, like again, when I first came across Brunt Workwear for a potential episode of Startup Story, you know, some of the challenges I kept thinking through is like, oh my goodness. I mean, the inventory complexity must have been so challenging. Now knowing a little bit of how your MGEMI story may parlay into this, as well as all the conversations you had alongside Ben Fisher. But one, how much capital did it take to start Brunt Workwear? And then two, how challenging was your first product, or did you launch with one SKU? Did you have multiple SKUs, the inventory? Like, how did you get to all those decision points?
My thesis for the business was I wanted to build it incredibly lean. I've seen two, you know, in startups, there's one extreme is bootstrapping and the other extreme is you can raise tens of millions of dollars and build big infrastructure. And I've seen those go sideways more often than not. I wanted to at least build the business to get product market fit first before I scaled it. Versus going in with, hey, we got it. If we don't hit product market fit, we're in trouble.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of my thesis of I wanted to build it right. I wanted to take the right time, really invest in the brand versus having to move at lightning speed and make quick decisions and shortchange a lot of things. So that was kind of my overall thesis to build Brunt Workwear, which is different than most venture-backed businesses, definitely of the past 10 years and still more common today. So didn't raise an enormous amount of capital to get the business started. Had a couple close parties that after, you know, probably 6 months of pitching and all that stuff that ended up investing in the business and over the past 2 years until we got to launch. Right. And that was the whole thesis was get it to launch, see if the receptivity, where that is. So that was kind of my thesis, my strategy of how to operate the business. And then when it came to the inventory complexity, you know, the work boot market is massive. There are 200 different SKUs. If you really want to cater to every single niche within the industry, there's an incredible amount of SKUs. There's specific boots for specific jobs that, you know, a lot of these heritage brands make. And if you're not in that specific job, you would never buy that boot. So I knew I couldn't do that because the capital, I would have needed millions of dollars to pull that off. Through the research and through data and analyzing competitors and reviews and all that stuff, ended up coming up with what I believed was the tightest assortment to cater to as large a group of the country as possible, knowing that I wasn't serving every single one to start, but as we get bigger, I will continue to expand. In a perfect world, I would have had one work boot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like the dream, you know, the away travel and all that stuff, that would have been the dream. One product that you can sell all day long, but I knew that there's variations of safety toe, non-safety toe, tall, 8-inch for waterproofing and short. And so I had to have enough assortment to be able to build a big enough business, but I couldn't bet it all on one, right? And so, but I also didn't want to require the amount of capital to build out a large line.
Yeah.
So that was being very disciplined. It's very easy to build a large SKU count and assortment. Very hard to build a small SKU count and stay very disciplined in one colorway. You know, we have one colorway in each of our boots. We very easy to put five colors out there and see what sticks.
Yeah.
The whole takeaway from all that was from capital to inventory to planning was really discipline. I've seen that work for people, and I've seen people that don't have the discipline. I've also seen it go very poorly.
Yeah. Now that you are building something from your on your own from ground zero, when you look back at the various opportunities you've had, what would be three significant differences? I mean, and it could be any number. I arbitrarily threw out three. What are some key differences you see in this chapter of your entrepreneurial journey versus everything else you've done?
So number one was believing in the idea, even though like the first 20 people I talked to said it was a terrible idea and still going on, right? Because earlier in my career, I didn't have the confidence or the wherewithal to think I could, you know, if someone told me that, believing in the idea, the opportunity, the brand and myself, full stop, right? Yeah. Early on, we sat down with a big CEO of a company in this space. I pitched the idea in front of a bunch of other investors. And he literally was like, this is the worst idea I've ever heard. And it didn't change my opinion at all. I was like, he's wrong and I'm going to show him. I never had that before, right? Yeah. I never had the, no one's going to change my mind that this is a huge opportunity. So that was different. Before I had a lot of people would impact or influence my confidence in all that stuff. And so that's far and away number one. Number two is, especially when I was by myself, I did this for about a year before I even had a co-founder and a bunch of folks, is doing everything solely. Investors, presentations, pitching, all that stuff, to working with a branding agency and tweaking the littlest things from a brand perspective, to designing, working with designers on the boots. Full spectrum, top to bottom, the highest of highs, the lowest of lows.
Yeah.
That was is really like the second big difference here, where before I had we had big teams.
Yeah. I love it. Absolutely love it. You know, where do you see Brunt Workwear, if we're having a Where Are They Now episode in, let's say, 5 years, what do you see with Brunt Workwear?
So I want to be known as the goal, right? It is the modern workwear brand that has listened to the customers, made products, solutions, and services that cater to their lifestyle and take care of them at scale. The reason, you know, I like disruption, and that's a coined term, but these big brands are so big, they're huge, they're 100 years old. They need to cost engineer their products to get more money out of them, right?
Yeah.
And my belief is over time, and my investors wouldn't love this, but if I scale and get cost savings, I actually want to pass that off to the customer. You know, I don't want to build this to be just a, you know, of course, you know, capitalistic, you know, have venture investors and all that stuff. But I know that if we take good care of the customer in all capacities, they're going to take care of the brand and vice versa. So 5 years from now, it's truly have disrupted the entire category and are the brand that not only the target customer going after, but much older and much younger are just in love with, just because we take care of the customer so well.
You know, it's interesting as you were sharing that segment right there, that what you see in 5 years and the brand affinity that you want, that you have for your customer, but that you want your customer to have for Brunt. I was starting to think through a couple of brands, again, as an outsider from your demographic, I started thinking through some of the brands that they probably have that type of affinity and loyalty with. And so I want to shoot out some brands and you tell me if you think my understanding of that type of affinity you're seeking is accurate. Yeti.
100%. That's the number one.
Yeah. And again, I'm thinking through the ads that I see that try to speak to it. Budweiser.
Yep. Yep.
Even though it's garbage beer for all those listening.
Bud Light, but yeah.
Yeah, Bud Light. Yeah, yeah. Again, even for those listening, that's garbage beer, just for the record.
Yeah.
but what are some other brands? Those are the ones that come to mind. What are some other brands? I mean, Dickies, is that Carhartt? Are those two of them? No. Like, what are some other ones that they have a loyalty and affinity for?
Chevy, Ford.
Mm, okay.
Snap-on Tools.
Okay, yeah.
Tool brands. Yep. So Milwaukee, very for certain brands. Milwaukee, for example, is a hot brand in the space. Incredible affinity for that brand. So it's funny as you think about a lot of my buddies, you see these brands in tattoos. You see Yeti tattoos.
Yeah,
you
see
when you start your brand starts showing up as a tattoo, you know you've got something.
No kidding.
And you see Snap-on Tool, you see a lot of tool brand tattoos, you see the truck brand tattoos, Yeti hands down. It's stuff that fits into their life. So think about that. They're getting up in the morning, they're putting on their clothes, but then they're getting into their truck. So the truck brand is very important. Yep. They're spending a lot of their day in their truck. They then have their Yeti cooler, their Yeti lunchbox after work or whatever it may be. It's brands that fit into their lifestyle and serve a meaningful purpose. And the tool brands, because they're using the tools at work.
I love it. I love it. Just in this conversation, I can see how underserved this market and how misunderstood this market is, because I mean, when you think of loyalty, like that is the demographic you, I mean, they are tattoos for crying out loud. No one's getting a Kylie Jenner tattoo on their forearm because of her makeup or whatever. Like when you think of all the brands, Nike's a tattoo you'll see people get, right?
Yep,
I mean,
yep.
When you think of all the brands, like what a great metric. Again, would they tattoo it? And I could see Brunt tattoos. I'm not going to lie. Like I could see it. I could see it in the future. So
I don't think we're too far away at this point.
I love it. Unfortunately, you know, we could be going for much longer because I'm just fascinated at this demographic, the story, the how Brunt wants to serve them. But I want to honor your time as well as my listeners' time. And so, you know, when it comes to the final three questions of every startup story, the first one is about the idea of entrepreneurship. You've seen a lot of different angles of entrepreneurship as well as a life outside of entrepreneurship and even within your customer persona. So when you think of the idea of entrepreneurship, as you understand it, do you believe anybody can be an entrepreneur? Not that they want to be, because not everyone wants to be, but do you believe anybody can be an entrepreneur, or is it something you're born with?
I believe anyone can be an entrepreneur if they genuinely want to do it and be it. Until I met Ben and worked for him, I wasn't the most creative person. I didn't know a lot of these things, but you know, it's been, you know, I put in 10 years. Right. Yeah. And I kind of learned entrepreneur, you know, and I had the things when I was younger, POGs and stuff like that, but like that's small time. And and so I learned it and I wanted it and I surrounded myself with the people that could turn me into it essentially. So I think I'm an example of it worked. Right. And so I do believe the difference is it's, you know, everyone thinks it's a sexy term and all this stuff. It is 24/7, 365. And if it's not, then it's likely not going to work. And it's really just, you want to be an entrepreneur, but you don't really want to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the biggest thing is I do. I actually do think, and by the way, maybe there, you know, some people don't have the skill set or the capability or the capacity to do it. But generally, if you wanted it bad enough, I think you can make it work. A lot of folks aren't willing to make the sacrifice that it's going to take.
You know, Mike Tyson, I think it's Mike Tyson who has a quote, you know, everyone wants to be a boxer till you get punched in the face, right?
Exactly. Exactly. I wake up almost every morning and I get punched in the face. When I read my email, I get a punch in the face. After I make my coffee, I get another punch in the face. And then before noon, I get another punch in the face.
Oh, I love it. That's entrepreneurship for you. So the other part of entrepreneurship is this breaking down this persona. And that's why the Startup Story was created. This idea that entrepreneurship is a solo journey. The headlines espouse it that it's a matter of you sleeping on your buddy's couch with a laptop and all of a sudden you're building out the next Airbnb. And that's just how it's just great fortune, if you will. But what those who have been a part of it know is that it's not a solo journey. There are shoulders we have stood upon to get to where we are today. And so when you look back across your entire life's journey, who are the people you point to with such immense gratitude for their contribution to where you are today?
There's a few people. I mean, there's across the spectrum. The big ones are when I was in high school, I had a track coach. So similar to my grades, I was a very good runner. I didn't even like to run. I played soccer, but I would run to stay in shape for soccer. But I was the best 800 runner on our team. The problem that I faced was there was no one that could push me in practice because I was just a good runner. And it's a long distance, so not a lot of people like to do it.
Yeah.
What I learned from her early on was she would scream at me in practice. Why aren't you beating your times? Why aren't you beating your time? And I'm like, I won. Like, she's like, doesn't matter. You need to keep pushing. And so the big thing that taught me was you can't just try to beat the people or try to beat the market. It's you got to actually push yourself to the extreme limit because you've got more gas in the tank. And then eventually when I went on to states and all those things, I wasn't winning anymore because those people were better. You know, I was practicing to beat the people around me, so pushing way beyond your limits. That was like very eye-opening for me.
Yeah.
And then I'd say the second was just the opportunity that Ben Fishman at Rule of Law gave me, right?
Yeah.
He was patient. I knew nothing. Could have been a rocky road. And just giving me a seat at the table and allowing me to prove myself was, you know, that made all the difference, right? So that was very important.
I love it.
And then the other was, when I was young, my dad, I used to play Little League and I was really tiny. So I was young for my grade. So when I was in Little League, my first season, I struck out or got walked. I would not swing the bat at all. I was terrified of the pitchers. I was tiny. I weighed like 90 pounds. And my dad said to me, he says, you can't hit the ball if you don't swing the bat, which was like crazy, right? To connect that dot. And so then the next year I got a little bigger and then I swung and I hit a grand slam like to start the season off. That carries with me today is like, you can't hit a home run if you don't even take a swing of the bat. Right. And I think about that a lot.
I love it. Oh man. If I had to trim the episode to 20 minutes, my listeners hear me say this often, like that question would never go away because people need to understand if you're doing this in a vacuum, your percentage of burnout is higher than those who do it within community, who do it within connecting with others. Right. I mean, and so I love that I get to share that with listeners that you need to be connecting with other people to be to encouragement. It's also too, just the business side of it, the bouncing off of ideas and the vetting of things and the insight that your buddies gave to you, right? The, why aren't you building something for us? And so there's so much value by being in community. And if I could, I would afford my listeners one-on-one times with all of our founders so they could just ask anything and everything that they have for their business, but I can't. That'd be unreasonable. And so this last moment I'd like to have as a one-on-one moment with you and one of my listeners. And maybe the listener that resonates with you is the one who has been grinding at this for some time and just can't get any traction. Or maybe it's the entrepreneur who has a 9-to-5 and a book full of dreams and ideas, but is hesitant and reluctant to move forward on something for whatever the case may be. Maybe they think it's because I have a mortgage and a spouse, I can't take that risk. Or maybe it's because they think they're 60 and they're too old, whatever the case may be. Or maybe it's the entrepreneur who just lost everything because of COVID in 2020 and isn't quite sure if they have what it takes to get up back on the saddle again. Whoever it is you want to talk to, whatever one of those personas, what would you say to them if you were having coffee with them right now and they were just trying to get your guidance on how to move forward into their entrepreneurial journey?
So the biggest thing I'd say is you have to understand whether you're, like you said, whether you're in your 60s or you're in your teens, you have to understand where you are in your life cycle and your lifestyle and what risk you can afford to take and how you can afford to take it. 15-year-old listener, you should be taking an incredible amounts of risk. You don't have a mortgage, you don't have a family, you don't have a lot of the things that as you start to get older become things that you need to sacrifice. And then vice versa, you know, like myself, wife, two kids, mortgage, all this stuff, right? Makes it less risky. You know, you have to approach it very differently. And then even later in life, you got to approach it very differently.
Yeah.
You have to look at where you're at in your life and assess the amount of risk you can take. And then once you assess the amount of risk you can take, which is maybe you can't just quit your job and start working on a startup. Maybe you actually have to come home at 5 o'clock and you actually have to work on it from 7 to 2 until it gets some traction or big enough or an investor says, hey, that's a good enough idea. And then that's your risk is, all right, I've got someone that's willing to invest in the business and then you can quit. And so I think it's assessing the risk and what you can do is number one, wherever you are in your lifestyle. And everyone has different, everyone has challenges, limitations. So one is the risk. And then it's what are the sacrifices that you're willing to make that happen? Are you willing to work 7 days a week, 365, calls at midnight, calls at 6 a.m., jumping on planes, or do you really not want to do that? And does your family, my wife, I love her to death, give her credit. She deals with a pretty difficult human being, which is my lifestyle. I'm up early, I'm up late. It's a sacrifice that we've both made for me to build Brunt.
Once you've had a few moments to process all the value that Eric Gerard brought us in this week's episode, please hit me up on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Instagram and share with me your thoughts on this episode. And lastly, if you've been around the startup story for any length of time, then you know how much emphasis I put on the idea that entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs. So please visit bruntworkwear.com and share it with your network. We'll include a link in the show notes for easy access. But even better yet, if you know someone who would benefit from their workwear, then introduce that person directly to Brunt. Again, the URL is bruntworkwear.com, and we'll include a link in the show notes. I say it in every episode because I believe it with my very being. Entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs, so let's show up for Eric Gerard and Brunt Workwear in a huge way as a way of saying thank you for all the value he delivered to us today. And now for my personal ask.
The Startup Story community has been so incredible about sharing our podcast with others, but we have more stories to tell and more people to reach. We too are a startup, and word of mouth is everything. So please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Startup Story, or on Twitter at StartupStory_. If you're on LinkedIn, please search for The Startup Story and follow our company page. LinkedIn is a really powerful way to raise awareness of the show. But the most impactful way you can help us grow our audience is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Or if you listen to the show via Spotify, then please simply share the podcast directly from your Spotify app or wherever you listen to the show. These simple actions can make a huge impact in getting these amazing founder stories out to the masses. And please make sure to tag or mention The Startup Story when you do share so that we can connect with you and say thank you directly. I'm so incredibly appreciative of the fact that you listen to the show each and every week. And I look forward to sharing these amazing stories with you every Tuesday with hopes of encouraging and inspiring you to start your story.
If you like this podcast and are thinking of creating your own, consider talking to my producer, Danny Osmond. He helps thought leaders, influencers, executives, and authors create, launch, and produce podcasts that grow their business and make a real impact in this world. You can contact him today at emeraldcitypro.com/startupstory.